Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're ringing in the start of our fifth season with dispatches from Portland, Oregon's biggest food festival, Feast Portland. We're bringing you words of wisdom on launching a food business from food blogs.
Most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit very quickly afterwards.
To ice cream shops.
Every city you go to, the Salt and Straw is completely different than any other city.
We'll bring you insights and anecdotes about the business of the business.
We were like, cool, we're going to do this. We're going to try to raise $75,000 and we'll see what happens. And it was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacking Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. From 1972 until its closing in 1983, Todd Barkin's Keystone Corner in San Francisco was widely considered to be one of the world's top jazz venues. The club played host to a slew of live performances from such legends as Stan Getz, Sonny Rollins, Miles Davis, and Betty Carter. German-born chef Robert Wiemeyer landed in the D.C. area in the 1980s and over the last three decades has earned the reputation as one of the country's most respected chefs, opening some of the capital's top eateries, including the acclaimed Marcel's. In April 2019, these two powerhouses teamed up to revive the Keystone Corner in Baltimore. On today's episode, we talk about the history of the Keystone Corner, how these two met, and how the idea to open one of the most historic jazz venues in the country came to be. And from the archives, we keep things jazzy with the 2000 performance by Scott Kohlberg Trio. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I'm here with Robert Wiedmeyer and Todd Barkin of the Keystone Corner Baltimore. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for inviting us.
So, Todd, we're going to start with you, a living legend, actually, an NEA jazz master. But let's go back before that. How did you get your start into music, and what was the first band you saw that knew that you were on this fated path?
Well, I mean, actually, I mean, I started playing piano as a little toddler, and my parents took me to hear Louis Armstrong, and that's when I started, really. I mean, I was a little kid, and I heard Louis Armstrong. And they had a lot of jazz records and Frank Sinatra records around the house, and I started kind of falling in love with the music, just as a kid falling in love with something, and it was really excited me. And then I met a guy named Rossan Roland Kirk, this blind genius who played three saxophones at once. I met him on the bus going to a baseball game, and he became a mentor to me. And so I started getting a real kind of sophisticated education in jazz almost by accident. And then I went to Oberlin College, and I was like a lot of kids. I went to the West Coast looking during the summer of love. I went to Oberlin College, and I was still playing a lot of piano. And I went there, and I became a pianist in a Latin jazz band at night and a customs broker in the daytime. And I went to a nightclub to get a gig for our band. We worked a lot. We were a Latin jazz band playing Mongo Santa Maria music at that time in the 60s and early 70s. And I went to this club to get a gig. And then the guy says, well, I don't think jazz will work here because it's a beer bar, but I'm opening a big rock club across the bay. Why don't you get by this club and hire your own band? So all of a sudden, and I said, I only have $8,500. And to make a long story short, he took $5,000 down and $400 a month. And all of a sudden, at the age of 25, I was a club owner. So that was the beginning of Keystone Corner. And that was the beginning of my whole career. You know, here it is, you know, some 47 years later. And I'm still presenting jazz. And I'm working with a wonderful guy like Robert Wiedmeyer. And we're bringing some love to Baltimore. So that's kind of the story. I mean, basically, just to finish just a little few more details, I built the Keystone Corner into an internationally famous jazz club kind of by the seat of my pants. And then later on, I moved to New York and started working with Wynton Marsalis at Jazz Lincoln Center. I became a programming director there. And then I got the award as an NEA Jazz Master last year, in 2018, and that's how I met Robert, because he was hosting one of his flagship restaurants. It's called Marcel's. It's the number one French restaurant in Washington. It's an everything restaurant. It's one of the great restaurants of the world. And he was the host of our NEA Jazz Masters dinner, and we became fast friends there, and we decided, as our friendship grew, that we would work together on opening a great place for food and great music together. And that's how this project in Baltimore developed.
So let's go back to your 24. You're handed the keys to your club. I know obviously your band played, but what were some of the early bookings that you did and some of the early people in there? And how did you determine how are you going to get people? I mean, it wasn't like that you have the open accessibility today. How did you start to curate the future legendary club?
Well, I mean, actually, I inherited two nights with Jerry Garcia and Merle Saunders. The first two nights that we had the club, they actually had canceled a bunch on Freddie Herrera, who was the owner of this club, who opened the bigger club in Berkeley. They had canceled a few times on Freddie, so they owed him a couple nights. And Freddie said, hey, Todd, I'll throw in a couple nights. You know, Jerry Garcia and Merle Saunders, they'll pack the joint for you, help you get off the ground. So Jerry and Merle came in and played for me, and it was, of course, people lined up around the block with no advertising whatsoever. So that was the beginning of the Keystone Corner. And then the earliest people that really lifted the place off its foundation, besides Jerry Garcia, who did the same, were like people like McCoy Tyner and Rossan Roland Kirk, my childhood friend. I mean, and basically I had met some people just being a musician, but a lot of it was just just sheer chutzpah, just sheer, finding people and calling them up and calling a lot of artists direct and a few agents and a few managers and just building up a very quick network. I mean, but McCoy Tyner was really important. Rosson, Roland Kirk, Freddie Hubbard, Ron Carter, who opened the new Keystone Corner in Baltimore, they all organized a benefit concert for me, and that I bought a liquor license. And that was Elvin Jones and Max Roach. And we did a big benefit concert at the Paramount Theater in Oakland, and we raised $85,000 for a liquor license. Then another childhood friend, Grover Washington, was another friend, and George Benson was another friend. They helped me organize a benefit, and we built a kitchen, and we built and knocked a couple walls down and added more seats. So that was the real nucleus of the club. I mean, it was a labor of love, but it developed into a real cultural haven, and that's what we're doing in Baltimore too. We're building something that's important for the community as well as a business. And this time, the major difference is that we have the wonderful added benefit of having a great grand master in the food department, making it even a multi-dimensional cultural center. We have food that is on the same phenomenal level as the music, and that to me is a very, very special part of what we're doing now.
When you knocked down that wall, what was the food that you were serving?
Falafel. That was the food I was.
That makes sense in the 72, 73.
Yeah. I mean, the first food when we knocked down, when we built the kitchen, I had a soul food kitchen. And it was a lady who was a really good soul food cook. But I very quickly learned that I had to make a choice between being a full service restaurant and running a jazz club. It was a little tiny kitchen, and it was very difficult to run it with the kind of mass produced food the way you would need to do for 180 people. It was a little tiny kitchen. So what I wound up doing was subbing it out to a falafel restaurant down the street, and we became a concession for them, and it was good for us and good for them, and it was great falafel and it was great hummus and everything was wonderful, and it was something that actually helped pay our rent, but we didn't go to any financial great risk. Robert brings in a whole organization, the RW Restaurant Group, which is, part of the organization of the whole Keystone Corner of Baltimore. They are the anchor for the whole operation. So it's a partnership between the music and the food.
Well, Chef, we always tend to find out on the show that most chefs' first love was music. And I know from your history that probably rings a bit true. What type of music did you grow up seeing, and how did you balance that with your early days of cooking?
So my early days of music were like my music genre is really from like 1967 to like 1978. Everything from Cosby, Stills, Nash and Young to, Buffalo Springfield to, the Flying Burrito Brothers, to Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin. Really rock and roll, the British rock and roll scene, the Dead, and so on. So I was really into music all my life growing up. I think one of the first concerts I saw when I was visiting from Europe, I saw Santana and Tower of Power in Oakland, at Oakland Coliseum when I was like, I think I was 15 years old. And that was in 1975, I believe. But I just had this love for music. And like you said, a lot of chefs love or were really into music, too. It's very true.
Yeah. When did you get into the kitchen and start honing your skills?
So I got into the kitchen at a very young age. My mother was an unbelievable cook, like most chefs. So I gravitated towards the kitchen, hanging out with my mother, going to the markets. Because I lived in Germany for 15 years, then in Belgium. going to the markets with my mom, going to the fish market, the meat market, the flower market. You know, my mom knew where to find the best blackberries, the best, you know, fish, and just cooking with my mother. And then I just carried on with it, and I never looked back. I just, you know, I just started working in kitchens, and that was it. Went to culinary school in the Netherlands and worked in Brussels, and then came over here first stint, and came, went back and came over here. I don't know if you read my bio, then I was at the Four Seasons for a long time and the Watergate Hotel. Then I opened up my own place in 1998, Marcel's on Pennsylvania Avenue, named after my first son, who's a bassist. He's a musician. That's one reason why I got into more of the jazz. My son was a straight-up jazz player, still is today. He lives in Nashville, and he plays in a couple bands. And he's only 20 years old. He's as old as the restaurant. He'll be 21.
Amazing. And you also had a music venue in one of your other restaurants, too, or you tried to have music there, correct?
Yeah, I still do. So I have Villain and Saint, which I opened up four and a half years ago in Bethesda, Maryland. And it was strictly, I mean, when I opened that place up, it was all about just the musicians. It was all about original music. And, you know, one thing I found out about being a chef was, you know, when I would do these dinners around the world, actually, with other chefs, we were kind of like a band. It's like, okay, you're doing first course, you're doing second course, you're doing third course, I'm doing fourth course, you're doing fifth, you're doing sixth. And we would pull up to a lot of these places, and there'd be nobody there to help us. Be like, you know, there's no one to help us carry our stuff in, no place for us to go hang out, no place for us to get a drink. And then we'd have to clean up, and, you know, it was just a mess. So finally, we kind of bound together. Our chef said, look, when we do these dinners, we want help. So I found out after a while that musicians were kind of the same way. Oh, here, you want a burger? Okay, so you get a burger for doing the gig. Go stand in the corner over there. And, you know, so when I opened up Villain and Saint, it was all about the musicians. It was about treating them right, helping them bring in their gear, having a green room, feeding them anything off the menu they wanted. And, you know, that's how we started Villain and Saint. And I had the villain side was very, like, you know, I had pork shoulder, I had ribs, I had, you know, a burger. And the Saint side was vegetarian. So we were moving along fine, but then I got wrapped up in other things, and I lost a different manager, and this happened and that happened, and, you know, slowly the place wasn't doing exactly what I wanted to do it anymore. It's still open, but it could be 1,000 times better.
So set the scene before we get to the opening. What was, because I know that you're already changing it and it's only been open for a few months, like, what was the jazz scene in D.C. Pre-opening?
Well, that's one of the reasons that we wanted to do what we did, to bring, like I said earlier, some love to Baltimore. There actually hadn't been a jazz club in Baltimore per se for over 30 years. And the last place there was called Ethel's Place, owned and operated by the legendary Ethel Ennis, jazz singer from Baltimore. So they hadn't really had a jazz club. And the jazz scene started there in a place called Pennsylvania Avenue in the 50s and 60s. And then the Left Bank Jazz Society became the real anchor. And that was a Sunday afternoon jazz concert that was quite legendary in the jazz world, the Left Bank. And it was every Sunday afternoon, either 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And we have what's called a Left Bank set here at the Keystone Corner, Baltimore. It's at 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And a lot of those people come to those sets, and they have some of the most dedicated jazz fans in Baltimore. And this has been a real breath of fresh air, like a beacon of light to these people who are very appreciative. There have been people that have come 8 and 9 times since we've been open. We've only been open
just over 4 months.
Just 3 months, and just a little over 3 months we've been open, and people have come 8, 9, and 10 times. So that it's just, we're now in the process of building our base, and we're going to broaden the musical palette a little bit and involve more you know, some dead music, some funk, some bossa nova. You know, we're going to broaden the palette. But right now, our opening was to reach out in a very solid way to the straight-ahead jazz audience and then broaden the audience from there. But there definitely have been a wonderful core audience to get this project off the ground. So, I mean, they really appreciate that.
Amazing. So we're going to take a quick musical break with a song from the archives, and then we'll be back here with Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you.
let's get into the club. Set the scene for me. It's obviously made for jazz fans, music lovers. What are the key components that you needed to make an incredible room?
Well, first of all, we had to build a sound system that was worthy of the institution and of being a major concert venue. So we had to get a real sound system and built in. We put a carpet on the floor to make the sound, you know, a little more evened out in the whole room. We built a stage and a sound system. When I first walked into the club, my heart kind of sank because there was a very huge bar. And I walked in when I first came to look at it in early February. I said, where's the stage going to be? And I walked around the bar, but then I saw a major alcove. And that is where the stage is today. And it's a wonderful stage. We love our stage. And
it's a big stage.
It's a big stage. It's the biggest stage I've ever worked with in this type of venue. So it turned out to be a wonderful concert stage that we built there, a wonderful sound system and lights and everything. We had to make it a combination of a concert venue with great food. And so, I mean, it really is a jazz restaurant, you know. We are really selling sound. And so we have to pay great attention to that and really pay close attention to that. And we're selling the sound as much as we are the food. The food, sound is food for the soul. So we're selling, you know, food for the stomach and food for the soul. So
Chef, when you're designing this menu, what is your approach to it, and how does it maybe differ from when you're doing Marcel's or your menu creation over the years? What goes into it, and what do you need to consider for the people who are coming to see the music, maybe first and eat second?
So one of the things I found because going to so many concerts and music venues my entire life, that normally the food was really bad in most of these places you go to. Now in New York, you can find a good couple of places that do a really good job with the food. But prior to all that, I mean, I think that most of the places you saw, the food really was never that great. And so you would go there and you normally wouldn't even eat. So when I was thinking of Keystone Corner, you know, I was thinking, you know, 72, you know, when it first opened. I was, you know, Todd had turned me on to a lot of documentaries, you know, about Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and how strong the jazz community was up there. And there was the Crawford Grill. So I did a little like history work on the menu, so I could come up with a menu that was very approachable to everybody. I didn't want it to be like Marcel's in any which way or form, where the majority of the menu is French. I wanted it to be food that people go, "Oh wow, that sounds really good," but when they got it, it wasn't just a regular old wedge salad. It was a piece of, you know, it's like a beautiful piece of artwork to look at, and, you know, and everything's made in house. And you know, the deviled eggs are like, you know, just gorgeous to look at, and they're just really, really tasty. But I wanted to be food that what I would call Americana, like with a retro fit to it. So I've got a corn and crab bisque that I serve, you know, with popcorn on top of it. You know, just little plays on things that you normally wouldn't see. But I didn't want it to be too fussy, but I just wanted to be great execution of flavors that would appeal to a majority of people. So that anybody, you know, would go into in there and go, "Wow, that's, I really want to eat this, or I really have to have that." One of those menus you can't really make up your mind what you want to eat because it all sounds good and it's all familiarity.
I mean, things that people really like, they keep commenting on the Crawford Grill sold chicken, and the Gulf Shrimp and Grits are popular, and the deviled eggs. Some people go nuts over the deviled eggs, you know.
So it's just stuff that people are, you know, that, and then when they get it, they go, "Wow, this is different. This is really cool."
I've had a lot of comments because I'm there every day. I get a lot of comments about the jumbo lump crab cake sandwich. That it's the best crab cake sandwich that a lot of these people have ever tasted, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, in Baltimore, you got to have a great crab cake sandwich. In Maryland, you do.
100%. So, Todd, when you're relaunching iconic venue, I mean, no pressure, of course, but when you're curating that early lineup and you're thinking about, you know, what are you going to say four decades later, what is the thought process behind it? You know, I know that you mentioned that you really wanted to make it for Jazz People first in your program, but when you're reaching out to people, and I know that you're, you know, you could reach out to anyone, how are you building that and how are you positioning it to the people who are jazz fans and also for the DC?
Well, I mean, I think we're just going for as high quality as we can. I mean, you know, I talked to Robert even before we opened, and I said we have to, you know, make a statement, and I think we've been successful in doing that. I mean, it isn't something that you can do that analytically, but you kind of got to do it with your gut. I mean, in other words, just try to get the best musicians who are still here, who can recreate. And obviously, Ron Carter was a logical opener because he was so integral in the original Keystone, and he's still at the very peak of his powers, and probably the number one ranking bass player, jazz bass player in the world. So he was a very logical and a very fitting, you know, person to help get the ball rolling there. But the other people, I just, you know, a combination of what kind of how exciting a performer they are. And then try, you know, my concept of booking has always been a kind of architecture, like a sonic architecture. In other words, like we opened up with Ron Carter for three nights, and then we had Kenny Garrett for three nights. So Ron Carter has a more of a chamber jazz. Kenny Garrett's a more of a contemporary, you know, so you have to have variations on the theme. So you try to have a real good contrast going on, so you don't have 2 weeks with just the same kind of programming. You have, you know, alternation, and then bring in a singer, and then bring in, you know, another kind of music. Yeah, the Duca da Fonseca, who's been a major part of my jazz life for the last several decades, even at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where I helped create Dizzy's and develop that into one of the most successful jazz clubs in the world. And he's kind of the inheritor of the tradition. I had Ayrto Moreira in the original Keystone Quartet. So there's always been a strong Brazilian component, and there's going to be more and more Brazilian music as part of this club. And it's been an underdeveloped element in Baltimore, so I feel very excited about that and heartened that there are things we can do to build up appreciation for different aspects of this art form. And Eddie Palmieri, Latin jazz. I mean, just being able to go from straight ahead, you know, from Eddie Palmieri to a straight ahead band. Eddie Palmieri is probably the king of Latin jazz at this point. And he just played for four nights for us, and he's coming back for two full weeks in December because it was such a, and he's going to go into all the schools in Baltimore and teach about Latin music in between two four-night engagements. And so it's all about contrast and building up, you know, architecture. So, I mean, it's hard to verbalize, you know, exactly how, but I really...
It's like painting a picture.
It is exactly like painting a picture, like the chef does when he organizes a menu or even a meal, how he sets up a plate. You know, you're really setting a plate, and you do that in music as well as in food.
I mean, and chef, you know, jazz is so famous for variation. Do you see that once the menu gets established that you will begin to riff in the kitchen and maybe adapt to the performer or throw something special on there that matches and pairs with the music that's happening that night?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we will definitely be doing that type of stuff. I mean, when, you know, we've got a Latin jazz band in there, we'll be doing some Latin food. Like when Ron Carter played and he really liked Seafood Primavera, I made that for him. You know, we're there to give an experience on all levels, on sound, feeling, you know, nurturing of your soul with food. So when you walk out of Keystone Corner, you get, you know, hopefully you walk out of going, that was unbelievable food, unbelievable music, unbelievable service. And I just feel like I just, you know, I can't wait to come back and do that experience again with some more friends.
Yeah, but a lot of people talk about it as an experience, and that's really encouraging to us because, you know, that's not how people talk usually when they go to hear an act in quote unquote a club. I mean, to say that was a wonderful experience,
right?
And now we have We've not only revitalized the Keystone Corner legacy, but we've revitalized even the practice we had right from the very beginning. We had what are called Keystone cards, where you get, and originally the Keystone card, you won't believe this, but the Keystone card originally sold for $25 for 10 shows. That's $2.50
a show,
a punch. And now, you know, they're $100 for 5 shows or $200 for 10 shows. And people are buying Keystone cards, and that's enheartening too, because that's like a commitment to the whole experience. That means you like.
That means you're buying in. Yeah. You're buying into like being part of the club or the restaurant club.
Right. So I mean, and we're experiencing a very good reaction to that. So I mean, it's hard work, but it's well worth it, and it's very encouraging how much the community really appreciates it. It makes all the difference in the world.
And for Todd, for those who don't know, the honorific jazz master, what is it? How do you get it? What comes with it? And what type of class of jazz aficionado gets bestowed such an incredible title?
Well, I mean, to me, it's equivalent. It's the highest award that our government gives in jazz. The roughest equivalent would be saying it's like a Nobel Prize for jazz. And what makes it particularly moving to receive it is it mainly comes from your peers. It comes from people like Ahmed Jamal and Eddie Palmieri and living jazz giants who are involved in voting on this honor. And it's accorded to both instrumentalists, singers, people who are significant advocates and presenters and producers of the music. So all categories. When I was inducted into that Hall of Fame, into the NEA Jazz Masters Hall, it was with Pat Metheny and with Diane Reeves and with Joanne Brachin. So it was a wonderful class. That was my class in 2018. So it's a very small but wonderful, fraternity, sorority, brothers and sisters who are in that group. So it's a really wonderful honor. Only a few people a year get it. And Todd,
you're one of the few that have been nominated. That's a promoter, jazz club owner, and promoter and producer.
Right, very few, and the other ones, the ones that have received it, like Warren Kiepnews and George Avakian, are my heroes.
Right.
So I feel very moved to be one of the few people in that category who's received that award.
Incredible.
It's like I tell my friends, I'm an overnight sensation in 56 years.
That, by the way, I can tell you that every chef and a musician can say the same thing, unless for some reason they're 16 and they flame out.
Right.
Final question to you. This is a collaborative question, as would seem fit. What is the perfect night for you guys? Who's on stage? What are they eating? What are they drinking?
Wow. Well, for me, I'd be starting off with a bottle of champagne. I'd be having a bottle of Billcart Simon Rosé, and I'd probably want to hear, for me, I probably would love to hear the Duke of Devonseca again play there. They were unbelievable. And I'd probably be eating my deviled eggs followed by my crab cake. Or no, probably not my black bass, my fried black bass with Brussels sprouts and the chili sauce.
And I would have to have a sentimental, I would have a perfect night for me would be hearing an incredible set by the gentleman we just mentioned, Eddie Palmieri, where it seems like the whole house is levitating. Those are experiences for me which are. And it happened again with Gary Bartz playing this week at Keystone Corner. I felt like I closed my eyes and it was 1972 when Gary Bartz actually did play the Keystone Corner. And the music got, by the second set on the second night, I closed my eyes and it was 1972. And that's an incredible feeling because it was like Dexter Gordon was playing there, or where the music, where you all of a sudden it has a timeless quality where you're listening every note and you're not really conscious that you're in a club or you're in a venue. The music kind of takes you
away.
Takes you to another to another dimension in space and time. And that to me, and I've become a huge, I'm almost an addict to the, you know, the scallops, the Robert scallops.
Scallops, yeah,
I love the scallops. I mean, I loved a lot of aspects of the whole menu, but that's one of my absolute favorites. You know, the scallops are just heavenly to me.
So, thank you both for joining. Where can people find you, find the listings, get tickets? Where can they get all the information?
Well, it's on Keystone, www.keystonecornerbaltimore.com and instantseats.com. You can easily get our tickets for any show, any night. And we're located in the Harbor East, wonderful Harbor East neighborhood of Baltimore. By the marina. It's a very picturesque and wonderful and lovely area.
1350 Lancaster Street.
1350 Lancaster at the corner of Lancaster and South Eden Street. And in the heart of Harbor East, right by the marina in Baltimore, Maryland.
And we've got the original sign from 1972. Not the original one, but the same layout of the original sign from 1972 at his original club.
Yeah, the original logo.
Logo, yeah.
And there's a sign that says "Music Spoken Here," and then a huge reproduction of the original logo that was right out in front of Keystone Corner, right at Powell and Stockton in North Beach in San Francisco. So the original logo is up, and plus the sign that says "Music Spoken Here."
Incredible. Well, thank you both. We have another song from the archives. And then we'll be back with the second part of Snacking Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Before the fall, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Nine dudes in a shipping container. Matt, that's going to be it's pretty diverse sounds, those two bands. That's like the headliner and the second headliner.
Yeah, it's definitely an eclectic mix.
Who does the booking out here?
Out here, it's, Chris Theridis is the curator, and we have Nasir is the name of the fellow who actually books both L.A. and New York from New York.
Really?
Yeah, he kills it. He's very good.
Every week for L.A., right?
Every week, yeah. Four bands in both cities.
I mean, we book like, 40 bands a year, and that's like...
A struggle.
I make it look like a struggle.
It's Sisyphus every year.
Yeah.
Right.
But that many bands. But I guess also, like, you're just, if you're like, I'm sure it gets people come at him all the time.
Yeah. And, we have the benefit of a lot of valuable relationships and work that Chris Theridis has put in over the years. And also, it's a showcase that has gained some sort of awareness and notoriety. And so bands can come on and sort of become, it's a stop on a career for some people.
What type of stop?
The stop on the way up.
Okay. We play a school night, and that's where it ends.
Hopefully not the cul-de-sac of a career. But.
Yeah. But no, it's great, and it's all what I love about school night is that it's all discovery. I also like checking out all the early bands too, because like generally those kind of are just sitting there creepers on their way, not even a stop. Maybe like they're just rolling into town.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No stories.
Just new.
Yeah.
And you had Moses Sumney play on your show, who is now like on his way to whatever that is.
He was incredible. Worth all of the buzz, worth everything. He was incredible.
Yeah, he just did a piece for us as well, and it was just like, okay, like this is something really special. But Matt is also in town not just for this, but you're doing an event on Tuesday night for Fashion Week.
Yeah, we're doing an event with Revolve Clothing. It's a dinner. And as such, there is a food element involved that is of note.
And our secret surprise guests are those food guys. Hey, guys. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. We have Sushi Belly Tower here on Snacky Tunes. We met out in L.A. in a lobby, and then I came to your dinner, which was awesome.
That night.
It was on, what was that, 13th, 5th floor?
5th floor rooftop.
Yeah. And the guy, he runs all the elevators? It was so loud, and I was like, how does this happen? And
Wait. What?
He runs all... Elevator Mike.
Yeah.
Like all the elevators in L.A.?
Like, a lot of the contracts downtown, all the high-rises, like...
Oh.
Yeah.
He runs, like, a lot of them, right?
So, yeah, because you're like, how is he getting... Because you guys had a loud... It was a five-piece, right?
A five-piece horn.
Yeah. I was like, this is... Yeah. And like, oh, well, if they complain, they'll never get back to their apartment.
Exactly, I'll turn the elevators off.
Yeah, and all of L.A.
They were complaining all night.
Were they?
Yeah. Well, some people, there was two people in the building complaining, but I felt like there was a lot more love coming our way. I'm still bumping into people like, was that you guys doing that like live jazz? I was on my balcony like getting a free live jazz show.
Mike's just standing back there. It's like, say something nice, just in the shadow, just like sitting in the corner of the elevator. Be nice to those boys. So why don't you tell the people out here a little bit about yourselves and the food organization that you participate in.
That's a good way to put it. It's it's kind of an idea that was born out of a new version of sushi, a new version of receiving like premium quality fish. The Japanese in the classic format of Japanese sushi is always like with white rice and fairly high in the glycemic index. I know that sounds suddenly very technical, but I'll jump there because that was the inspiration. I was a former professional runner, ran at Stanford, ran the Olympic Games, and treated my diet really seriously. Mm-hmm. And so as I dove into like my favorite type of food, sushi, I was like, wow, how can I make this a little bit higher quality in terms of performance food? Because most performance food for runners is like pasta and carbo loading, and was kind of like untrue in terms of its performance value.
Sounds like my regimen.
So
it's my performance value. For sure.
Yes. Wait, so I'm a runner, right? Oh, okay. Yeah. It makes so much sense now.
So basically, like farm to table vegetables and like the best quality like bites you can get. And suddenly, I was through a little party at my loft in downtown LA about 19, 20 months ago, and a lot of people came and. Participated and they told their friends, and now we're at we're approaching 4,000 people in five cities and really having a great time pushing pushing this sort of passion project that, you know, I have an awesome team, and I couldn't be more grateful. It's been really fun.
Where did you pick up the knife skills?
Well, knife skills are a little bit, like, overrated in terms of their value, I think. I mean, you could use the butt end of a knife. As long as you have premium-grade sushi, I don't care if we mash it up and throw it on a spoon. It's going to be a rad bite of fish. Like, it doesn't really matter. I mean, at this point, I've put enough hours in to, like, you know, be okay at it. But I'm no, like, Hana Tsubaki or whatever that means. I'm no, like, Japanese.
Obviously. Yeah. For any of you who don't know who that is.
I don't even know who that is.
Everyone just here sort of like, oh yeah, that guy. They did the band thing. Oh yeah, I've heard.
Yeah,
him.
No,
oh,
we yeah, agree. No, we totally agree.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's amazing.
Yeah,
but I saw him before he got big.
It's basically.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, maybe.
And my right hand man Eric has been holding down the fort and keeping. He's definitely the fire behind a lot of it. So you know,
it's just a party that we would want to go to. Live music, the best food, put it on a rooftop, invite the coolest people around.
Only the coolest people.
Speaking of music, you guys brought the Scott Kolberg Trio with you today. How did you guys meet up, or how did they come? How did you guys start working together?
I actually met Scott a few weeks ago. I walked out, and he was lying on my couch at 7 in the morning.
Naturally.
He was on tour on the West Coast, and then after chatting for a few days, I was coming to New York to do these parties last month, and he had this band. I was like, do you guys want to play? He was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure.
And I also needed a place to live, so I was like, can I live in your house? He's like, yeah, sure.
Do you want
been with us since, yeah.
Do you guys want to play us a tune?
Yeah, we'll play a number.
Yeah, you want to play us a number? Okay. What's this called?
This is a song of mine called Banana Boat.
Okay. Live on Snacky Tunes.
Really Sunday nice. Jazz.
Ooh. Sunday jazz.
Some of that yazz coming at you.
It's so nice. It's like the perfect music for this type of weather with nine dudes in a shipping container. you know, just a casual. So one of the things that's really amazing is we talk about the spaces and the space you guys for. Can you talk about the space for your Tuesday event? Or is it a secret?
No, it's not. Well, yeah, probably shouldn't talk. Wait, are people like, how does this air? It's a five-story building in the middle of Soho with a pool with a window on it. It's an incredible space.
Yeah. It's my weekend house. So.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for letting us borrow
Yeah, absolutely.
It. I
yeah.
appreciate the break on the rental.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, only for, you know, 10% off. What are friends for? Yeah. But, I mean, space comes to define your events almost as much as the food does. So how do you guys find these locations? And you said that you were looking for a venue today?
We never have, like, an absolute certainty about where we're going to do these. That's just the nature of what we do. I think we found a pretty cool spot today. Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about it?
No.
I mean, when you say absolute certainty, are we talking like, like a month out, we kind of looking to it, or we're like 2 days out?
2 hours out sometimes.
I mean, I could never do that.
I've woken up, 40 people come to dinner and lost the venue. And been like, we don't know what to do. I'm sitting at a coffee shop, meet the person right next to me. She's like, I'm having a dance party. I was like, sick. You want to also put together a dinner party with your dance party? She's like, okay. Turned out being a 100-person dinner dance party until like 6 in the morning.
It was awesome.
So we get lucky. I don't know. Just constantly on the ground, raging. It's like, yay.
What you don't say is that we asked 50 people before and they just told us to get the fuck out of here. Get lost.
Yeah, we have. I think we can probably plug in Webster Hall. They've been really cool. What this is people come to our dinners through word of mouth, and then they ask us how they can help, usually. And lots of times it's a mutually beneficial exercise. You know, like Webster Hall wants us to kind of bring in some, 50 or 60 interesting, coolest people in the world, moment. And we just put up a, we went and saw it today. It looks really awesome, and we're going to probably do it there.
That's great. Where in Webster? There's a bunch of spaces.
Probably. It just kept unfolding.
I have another one. I think we're going to do like the secret back upper top floor room on the side, side room.
That's what I thought. It's a great room.
Yeah.
I've actually been to like some events up there. It's awesome.
And the live music. We think that, you guys are going to look great on that stage.
Yeah,
too.
That
There's
stage
like a really well lit stage back there.
Yeah.
So we'll probably put ourselves right out in front of that. But we might do it elsewhere on another night. Just random spots, office lofts, industrial spaces. Like as long as we can make the room intimate enough with lighting, we can work out in a cool dinner in a 10,000 square foot open space. As long as we can kind of like have a little sink to do some dishes and keep that flowing. And
is it propane, like portable burners, or is it mostly just like ceviche, sushi?
No, this is like. So think of Nobu without the rice and without like any Japanese-isms, just a bunch of jazz playing in the background.
Right, jazz and sushi?
Jazz and sushi, and it's mostly sashimi. So, we consider ourselves more like food artists and social artists. We're not trained chefs. We just kind of know how to put together really well-sourced ingredients. So,
right.
So 10, 12 course, like we're talking yellowtail, bluefin tuna. I'm sourcing all my fish from non-Japanese sources too because of that whole scene. So, the Fukushima thing. So there's a lot of like really awesome people I've met in that space. To put on dinner for a few thousand people over the past like couple of years, we've gotten into really awesome sources of our fish. So it's the best fish in New York. There's no doubt about it. At our party, I can say that with absolute confidence.
Shout out one of your sources if you feel free sharing.
That's a little tricky. I think I'll say that a lot of it is local.
Yeah,
local coast line caught, bled on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dude CP Lee who's my man. I could say that's his name. He's awesome. So
that's what I call him.
That's his DJ name, CP Lee. We want to give a shout out to him. He's been really awesome. He just really has been a blessing to get to know. And it took us a lot to get there. And we had to go out to Bronx in the middle of the night with.
Yeah, we had no source when we first came for our first tour. Right. It was just him and I in a U-Haul van with all these plates and our whole operation in the back. We're like 5 in the morning.
No, it was 2
in the morning. We just finished a party. We're like flying over speed bumps. All the plates are flying in the air. We're trying to get to the fish market.
It was definitely a Chevy totally Chase moment. Yeah, we were looking at each other going, what are we getting ourselves into? And we had to pull into this massive, you know, new Fulton fish market and ask around for premium bluefin tuna, which wasn't even really available at that store. You know, it's just a different coast. You know, it's a different thing. Here it's a little more fish and chips and
kind of
that side of things and cooked fish. And the way they manage fish is just different versus, you know, the Japanese and have a whole infrastructure on the West Coast from Seattle to San Francisco to L.A. It's a little bit different out there. So it took us some time. We were able to, like, just – we went there every single night for 10 straight days. And by the 10th day, they knew we weren't going away until we got behind the guy.
Yeah. And he just kept unfolding, too. Remember Bob?
Yeah, Bob was awesome.
Super old Bob.
These don't sound like real names.
He was like, I was a boxer. He was so cool, man. Just telling us stories. Of,
Bob
like, 40
was in Vietnam.
Years ago fighting underground, like –
Whoa.
Yeah.
Now he sells fish.
Now he sells massive.
He's been at the fish mart for, his whole life.
Yeah.
But he used to fight. And so we would go hang out just for like 6 hours.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. We come out of there and it's like light outside. And we go in at 2 a.m. And it's.
Why don't we get another song from the trio? What are you guys going to play?
We're doing a lot of different things. That was the last song was a song of mine. This time we're going to play a Stephen Foster song.
Great.
Who's a. Old American composer. This is probably like composed in the 1850s or something. Called Genie with the Light Brown Hair.
Sweet.
Gotta let that last vibraphone tone.
You gotta tone it out.
Matt, call it.
The last time I heard that song was Eugene Levy performing it in Waiting for Guffman. Am I right?
Yes. Well done.
As part of his, yeah, as part of his application for the
I totally forgot about that.
The musical.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a diverse background from like a wide range of influences. That song was written in 1850.
Yeah.
I mean, but it has been used like, I think I feel like I saw that in like a early like Warner Brothers cartoon, like a Roger Rabbit type vibe.
Yeah, it's just a, like American songbook, like traditional.
I wonder like what the requirements are to get into like the American traditional. Like, does it? I mean, and could you get into it? I guess you couldn't get into it now.
To have learned an instrument in the 19th century.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, if you just wrote a song in the 1850s, you were in. Like, the bar was super low, and then it just kind of got a little bit harder.
Yeah, it was chopsticks, and then that song.
Yeah. Are any of these events that you guys are doing tonight open to anybody listening, or how do people get to attend these events?
It's strictly word of mouth. I mean, I suppose, yes, they are available. Where there are seats, there's probably 10 or 12 seats available on Valentine's Day. We kind of are able to fluctuate. You know, if 30 people sign up, then we buy enough fish for 30 people. If 60 or 70 or 80 sign up, then we just kind of ramp up a little bit and make sure everyone has enough food to go around and make sure the venue can accommodate. But usually it's cool. But yeah, we have some seats available. There's a little email that people can respond to. It's sushibellytower@gmail.com and find out more information on the events.
That's so great. And then what other cities are you guys hitting up this year?
We've had all sorts of funny requests. We'll probably try to get across the ocean and hit London and do a bit of a European tour, maybe Spain and do some stuff over there. But and most immediately, Seattle, San Francisco, back to San Francisco, where we always have great support.
Chicago,
definitely. There's a huge food scene
there.
Let
it thaw out a little bit, though.
Well, I think that's one way of doing it. Like, we would enjoy it probably more if it was a little warmer, but I think they would probably enjoy it because we bring a little bit of heat to the table, you know, a little different experience right now. Yeah. But, yeah, back to Miami, we're going to do some stuff down there as well. And, of course, we're going to have, you know, New York is a staple for us. People in New York tend to get what we're all about, like, the second they walk in the room. Sometimes other environments, other cities take a little long, you know, just I don't know what it is about New York, but it's been all love since the first time we threw a gig.
Unless you're going to the fish market, then it takes about 10 days.
That's true. Yeah,
we had to earn it.
Yeah, they definitely don't hand it to you.
No, I mean, but you know, but once
that's
you
why
get
it tastes
it,
so good.
Yeah. I think this, you have to fight this city to exist in it. I think.
I believe you can if you can make it here.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
It's up. No,
it's a lot more sprinting through the streets.
Yeah.
Than
well, I mean, we're all runners here, based on our diets, right? Pizza's a runner's diet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. That pizza was great.
All right. Well, if you go, how do people find you, follow you, get a hold of you?
So our Instagram is Upstream Foods, just like it sounds. Swimming upstream to get premium ingredients, and our hashtag is SushiBellyTower.
And then again, sushibellytower@gmail.com to reserve some seats or just hit us up and see what nights we're available.
Matt, how can people find you?
Big news everywhere on social media.
Across all
platforms.
All platforms. And don't forget if you are around, school night starts in 30 minutes.
Well, school night doors open in 30 minutes. The band start at 8. So.
No, you need to get there at doors. What happens if it fills up and you miss it?
Yeah, we ask you to go over to Output.
Oh, okay.
Is that punishment?
No, I think it's actually much good. It's very cool.
And then, Scott, how do people get a hold of you?
Visit my website, scottkolberg.com, and there's a contact email.
And if you search Reverb, I think, what was the website, the Everlong?
It's hidden somewhere on the internet. That's,
just email Scott, he'll send it to you if you want that.
But the opening track, just to give credit where credit's due, is Chad Lefkowitz Brown on saxophone and Joe Hertenstein playing drums and Javi Santiago playing piano on that song. And here live with me in the studio is Chaim Peskov on drums and Jean-Louis Trebu on vibraphones. And my name's Scott Colbert.
I like to give credit where credit's due. Very classy.
Yeah.
And then don't forget we have our Bar Food Blowout on Tuesday night at Pork Slope. If you go to Snacky Tunes on Twitter. There's a link where you can buy tickets, or you can just show up. Doors are at 7:30. We'll be there with Jeep Nima Harlika. Radical Dads will be DJing.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
Love those guys.
You can hear their show and all shows podcasted. Just search Snacky Tunes on iTunes. And thanks to Andrew and Aaron.
Pack show.
Really big shoe.
Really big show. Actually, it is the 50th anniversary of Beatlemania, so.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Yeah. I've heard of that. <It's> a- almost as big as Moses Sumney. Not quite. All right, Scott. Well, you guys want to...
Let's take us out.
Yeah, take us out.
Sure thing.
Thanks for listening.
What's the name of the last song of a jazz set? Is there...
Like the closer?
The closing number.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, sorry. What was that? One more piece of information.
Yeah, just one more thing. If you guys want to hear Scott Kolberg live, they're going to be playing at Sushi Belly Tower.
That's right.
Underground on Valentine's Day.
With Smooth Jazz.
Yeah.
Coming at you live.
Yeah, coming at
buy
you
your
live.
Tickets now. Well, thank you guys. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
No, we'll not. We'll be in LA next week.
Yeah.
But the following week.
Yes, following week. All right, take us out, Scott.
Program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please Join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.